Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to, let me just have a quick Google, Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, or Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. It'd be nice if they could make their minds up about how that name's pronounced, don't you think? Maybe. Anyway.
Maybe they're just being realistic, getting it wrong, realistically.
It's like, well, Dumbledore doesn't get it wrong, does he?
Well, he wouldn't.
Yeah, well.
Waggle.
Yeah, he's a user of that very popular app, Grindel.
I see what you're trying to do.
You see it?
It's not really working, but I see that it's there.
I think you'll find it is. Appius Expelliarmus! Joining me over the next 45 minutes or so to talk about the 10th. This is the 10th film in the Wizarding Worldiverse of Harry Potter. That's exciting, isn't it? Means we could do a ranking episode on this now. Joining me over the next 45 minutes or so to talk about this movie in detail. I was going to say great detail, but we've only got 45 minutes. Our three Potterheads, not potheads, it's a very different thing. Three Potterheads of different. Are you big Potterhead, Helen O'Hara?
I wasn't. I was a moderate Potterhead, and then I did all those interviews for that thing we did in the magazine.
Oh yeah,
and kind of became one accidentally.
Accidental Potterhead.
Yeah.
Big time Potterhead is Ben Travis.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to talking through this. There's loads of stuff to dig into, big revelations, etc. Yeah, interesting developments all around.
There's a lot to talk about in this movie.
Yeah.
There genuinely is quite a lot to talk about in this film.
Probably should have given ourselves more than 45 minutes, but so it goes.
If only I had a time turner.
Hey, good knowledge.
You see, I know this stuff. And last but not least, where do you stand on Harry Potter, Amon Warman?
Moderate Potterhead.
Moderate Potterhead?
Yes, moderate. I love the initial Harry Potter books, and I've seen all the films, obviously, but yeah, I'm not on Helen's level, and I suspect I'm not on Ben's level, if he's saying what he... but yeah, Helen did take me to a wonderful Harry Potter shop the other day, which was really, really cool.
The House of Mina Lima in Soho. Yeah. If you happen to be in London, Soho, I highly recommend it. Just, you don't have to be a Potterhead. It's just a genuinely beautiful little place that is interesting to walk around.
And right now they've got Crimes of Grindelwald exhibition, right?
They've got all
of the stuff that they designed for this film. So,
and they've also got a Crimes of Grindelwald exhibition.
In the Grindelwald.
Hey! Alright, okay, we'll be getting into the film and we'll be answering or trying our best to answer your questions that you sent in to me via DM. Just after this next bit, Ben here interviewed the film's Davids. Heyman, producer, longtime producer of the Harry Potter movies, and Yates, director of the last six Harry Potter films. We're counting these two as Harry Potter films, okay? Just make sure everyone's on the same page with that. David Yates, David Heyman, very recently, and went full spoiler with him for about 20 minutes. So let's get straight into it now. And as ever, I should need to say about this point, but this is a spoiler special. We're going to be getting into this film. Third Act Revelations, ending the whole kit and caboodle. So if you have not seen Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, then hie thee to your nearest multiplex and buy a ticket and then come back. Okay? Are they gone?
Seem to be.
They seem to be gone. All right, here we go. David's, Yates and Heyman talking to Ben's, Travis and Travis. Enjoy.
Hey, Chris here. Just jumping in briefly to say that this interview was recorded in a hotel room and not under studio conditions, and therefore there were some sound issues. Sorry about that. There is a little bit of hissing and popping on here that may be uncomfortable for some, but if you are up for it, Yates and Heyman do talk lots about the ending here, Dumbledore and all. So, enjoy.
So, welcome to the Empire Podcast. Spoiler special for Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. Yes. We've got David Yates, the director of the film, and David Heyman, the producer. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, thank you. Looking forward to sharing the film with a lot of people.
Hopefully. Absolutely. And there is a lot to go through here, so I'm going to hop straight into it with the big gut punch just before the credits roll, that Credence Barebone, he is not Corvus Lestrange. He's not a Lestrange. He is a Dumbledore. He is Aurelius Dumbledore. That's a huge reveal to send people out with. What can you tell me about how Aurelius fits into the Dumbledore family tree? There are so many kind of possibilities there between Aberforth, who's Albus's brother, and Ariana and the history there. What can you tell me about that reveal and that moment?
It was always very much part of how the script started, and it was always the big climax of the script right from the very first draft. And I know this is a kind of spoiler special, but there's a lot to come in the next story that really, so at risk of not wanting to spoil what's to come, I don't think we'd probably want to talk too much about the sort of intricacies of the family tree, as it were, other than we were all gobsmacked when we read that first screenplay, that first draft, to see that that Credence was actually a Dumbledore.
We didn't know it was coming.
We all had the same experience.
You read it and went, oh my goodness.
And all those possible theories, is that what you want fans to be thinking of for the next couple of years in the run-up to the next? That there are various ways that this could play out of how he fits in.
Correct. And there's a very intricate, lovely, beginning of three that we discover a few things about.
I think one of the great pleasures of this film and of continuing to work in Fantastic Beasts is we are getting closer to the beginning of the Harry Potter stories, and the connective tissue between the two worlds, as it were, or the two time frames, becomes more pronounced. So clearly we do know that Grindelwald and Dumbledore is central to this this series, and we have an idea of in a broad sense of where that might go, but clearly Dumbledore is a character himself who, he's not exactly the Dumbledore of the Harry Potter films. In a way, this is the Dumbledore before, this is the making of the Dumbledore. But Dumbledore is someone who is riddled with demons. You know, when he's manipulating Newt or Harry, he's not doing it maliciously or with you know, he wouldn't want to harm them in any way at all. He's doing it for his own version of the greater good. I mean, Grindelwald talks about the greater good, but Dumbledore's really doing it to protect wizard kind and humankind. I mean,
you were mentioning there Dumbledore as a manipulator. One thing that we find out here is that it was actually Dumbledore who sent Newt to America in the first place. Is there any possibility that Albus Dumbledore knew about Aurelius?
No, it's a very key question. And the thing is, if he knows about Credence being his brother, I think that sort of presents certain issues and certain problems. So there's a level of discovery. He's always supposed to be all-knowing, but even the brilliant mind of Dumbledore sometimes can't see around a corner. You know, so I think, I mean, again, things are evolving in the third draft, and Joe has this amazing ability to kind of surprise us often with a revelation or two here and there. But we've been working on the assumption, and that this doesn't necessarily remain the case, because the script storytelling process is a fluid process, as you know. It's kind of, it's dynamic. That Dumbledore, there's a revelation for him too. But you know what? I mean, as we forge the story forward with Joe, she'll have a much clearer take on that. But in terms of, as we were working into the sort of meat and the bones of this story, we worked on the premise that Dumbledore was not aware of Credence's existence as his brother. Otherwise, he would have had a whole different sort of strategy. That was the principle of how we developed the psychology of how the actors were working.
It's funny, because I've just been looking at some materials that are going to go on the DVD. Sent, but probably haven't looked. But there's one about Dumbledore. And one of the things that Jo says that is, she sat down with Jude when he got the part, just the two of them. And she went through everything she knew about Dumbledore.
Wow. Okay.
Everything that happened before and everything that happened that leads up to the Harry Potter films, because she felt it was important for him as an actor to understand his character and to have a stronger sense of who he was. She said that she'd never told anybody before because exactly because of what David said. You know, she has very clear ideas, but she mm-hmm. is open to change. And actually, one of the incredible things about developing this screenplay is how, you know, she is so collaborative and is fluid and is figuring some things out as she goes, though she has a pretty clear idea of where it goes, mm-hmm. but being open to adapting and changing if needed. But I think now, vis-a-vis what you were saying about Dumbledore, leaving herself room to change, I think she's now settling in on what he knows and what he doesn't know and all that. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the actors knowing about their characters in the beforehand, it's often spoken about as Ezra Miller being one of the biggest sort of Potter fans in this new cast. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was his reaction when he found out that he was going to be a Dumbledore?
He went nuts. I mean, he is, you know what, he is such a passionate, lovely human being, and
mm-hmm. incredible.
He's a remarkable man, actually.
Young man.
Yeah, we're really we actually had a, as part of that sort of DVD sort of extra bits and pieces, we gave a special showing of key moments of the film as we were finishing it to both Ezra and Ivana mm-hmm. Lynch, who played Luna Lovegood, so they could see the sort of climactic moment when that reveal comes. I mean, obviously Ezra knew about it, but and the two of them, both complete Potterheads, mm-hmm. just, you could hear the sort of scream through the other half of the building when it came to that climax. And he was beyond excited. He brings a real rigor as well, Ezra, to the whole process, because he's sort of like that extreme fan who just loves the world. It was particularly important to him as he was growing up, as it is to a lot of the fans and the people who love this world. Mm-hmm. It was a companion to their kind of this developing years, as it were. So he has that sort of super enthusiastic fandom, but he also has a rigor and a sort of a real sense of craft when he approaches the character, mm-hmm. you know, and he's sort of able to juggle those two things of super fan, but also he is. We love him, actually. He's a good guy.
He's fantastic. And as Dave said, a real enthusiast, really mm-hmm. passionate about Potter, and also very brave and bold in his choices.
Yeah.
On screen and mm-hmm. personally.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the small moments in that final scene is with the Dumbledore connection, a phoenix.
Yes.
Is that Phoenix Forks, or is that a different phoenix that we're seeing? Do you know if that's the case? Was that mentioned in the screenplay that J.K. had written?
Oh, that's a good question.
Ooh, you know what? We're going to have to go and ask.
Let's phone a friend.
Okay, one second.
good question.
I don't know.
We don't know.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what the lifespan is for a phoenix.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I'll move straight on because I've got so much to ask you. Mm-hmm. In the as well in the sort of end game of the film, we see some of the lines being drawn, and Queenie ends up siding with Grindelwald, which is another sort of big surprise. When did you know that? Did you know that from the last film? What can you tell me about that choice?
We knew that was going to happen pretty much as we were finishing film one. Mm-hmm. Jo was very, she said, she was very excited about that journey for Queenie. And she shared it with us very early, even before we saw a draft of the script, that Queenie ultimately would be tempted over to, because she was the one character you would anticipate would not do that. Mm-hmm. And that was really fun to see that switch across. So we were all aware of it, and we gave Alison a heads up early that she was going to have quite an interesting journey in this second film.
Yeah, and I think the fact that even Queenie can go over mm-hmm. is really significant. You know, the fact is that for me, Grindelwald is a much scarier villain than Voldemort, because Voldemort was pure evil. Mm-hmm. People went over to follow Voldemort as much because of his power and brute force than his power of persuasion. Mm-hmm. The thing about Grindelwald is he makes sense to people. He speaks to the needs that people have. He understands his audience, mm-hmm. and he gives them what they want to serve his own needs. So I understand Queenie, who's wants to be with Jacob, but where the magical laws deny her that possibility. You can see why someone who tells her in his world, in the world that he will rule, mm-hmm. that she will be able to have what she wants. You understand why she goes over, and that makes it, to me, Grindelwald is relevant, he speaks to today, but he's also, because history repeats itself, a timeless villain, and I think he's incredibly scary.
You were talking about the power of Grindelwald, partly through his words, but also in his magic and the sort of blue flame kind of dragon that he conjures at the end. What can you tell me about that? Is that a spell? And it takes Newt and Theseus and Nicholas Flamel and everyone teaming together to try and stop that from going out of control. Is that a demonstration of Grindelwald's magical power? What can you tell me about that spell?
I think we loved the idea that... that people have to come together to join together to stand against something that is profoundly dangerous and threatening. And it was a sort of metaphor of joining together, which was probably the most important thing about that sequence. And when I was working with James Newton Howard and we were talking to him about the sequence, you know, the music he created was, initially it was very action driven, you know, and I said, James, that's not really the vibe. I said, this is almost like a celebration of when we join together to face down something that we all feel is wrong, and we need to put that back in the earth where it belongs, into history. And then he went away and he wrote a really beautiful elegiac sort of hymn, almost to sort of turning away the darkness and the threat of these extreme ideas and threatening ideas that would challenge everything that we take for granted. And it's a bit of powerful magic from Grindelwald sent out into the world, and the beautiful thing to us about that sequence was the fact that we're stronger when we work together against that kind of ideology.
And there are casualties there as well, because Leta, she dies in that scene. Is she really dead? Is she gone for good? Is that a final death? Or with that being a sort of magical spell from Grindelwald, is there a way that she could come back? Or is that, do you think that's the end of her story?
What I do think is that, you know, when you die, you die. I think death is real in Joe's universe. I think it's important that in the books and in the films that, you know, though Harry can have a vision of Dumbledore, and there may be a nearly headless Nick in Hogwarts, that ultimately dead is dead.
Yeah,
you know, I think that makes it makes death more painful. I think that's really.
And that's not to say that the sort of spirit form, as has happened in the Potters, people can't return with a message or, but I think. Completely agree. I think to sort of keep the emotional stakes of the world present, if someone gets killed, they have to stay dead.
I
can't see Leta coming back.
And when she turns to Newt and Theseus and she says, I love you, who do you think she's speaking to? Which one of them do you think she's speaking to?
I love the fact that you don't really know, and I love the fact that you see Newt suddenly feel it, she's saying it to him and Callum. I like the ambiguity of that moment, and I don't think you always have to be so definite in these moments.
My interpretation, and it was his call, I have to say, but my interpretation is that she loves Theseus. Theseus is her man for today. If she were not dying, she would marry Theseus and be very happy with him. However, Newt, she loves as a first love, and Newt will always be a part of her.
That's beautiful.
Lovely answer. Yeah. One of the things that we're left with that's a kind of driver through the film and also a tantalising kind of note at the end is the blood pact between Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Can you tell me a little bit more about what does that mean? How is that different to an unbreakable vow, which was also brought back in this film? And what does it mean that Dumbledore now has that blood pact?
Fundamentally, it means that they can't fight each other. And if they do fight each other, Dumbledore has to pay a terrible price. He has to... Fundamentally, he's breaking the pact. And he is then committed to doing something, which we'll discover in the next story. Again, so I don't want to really go into that too much, in too much detail. And it's the thing that stops them attacking each other in this initial start part of the story. And we develop that little scene where they make the blood pact to sort of convey the sensuality and the sort of their relationship. It's very difficult in these movies to Initially, the arc of their relationship is fundamentally the spine of things going forward in many ways. That's mm-hmm. where we're going. But to sort of convey how deep their relationship was, we created that wonderful little scene in the mirror when they bring their hands together.
I mean, the Dumbledore-Grindelwald relationship is obviously a hugely significant one and has shaped Dumbledore mm-hmm. and who he is today. The scars of that, all the power that relationship brought. And Joe, I just, again, sorry, looking at these little films that were just made, hearing Joe talk about that relationship, that it was clearly it was a sexual relationship, it was an emotional relationship. Mm-hmm. What she's interested in exploring is the emotional connection that the two of them had. And I think one of the things you did so beautifully with such limited time with them together is the power and the intimacy and the emotional connection that these two people had. It was really powerful in shaping them both, but in particular in shaping Dumbledore.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask Grindelwald, the sort of device that he has, the skull with the pipe, is there a name for that? Can you tell me a little bit more about what it's actually doing in that moment where it sort of conjures an image of World War II, I think is a really interesting note.
Grindelwald is a seer. He has this ability to foresee the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that skull device is an opportunity for him. It's just a sort of means which allows him to present his visions to the people who follow him. So it's fundamentally a part of that magic. But he has the gift of forward sight, basically,
mm-hmm.
and which is an extra threat to our key protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have a name?
I don't know we ever gave it a name, actually.
We probably gave it for a name, but filming, but I'm not sure we should repeat
it.
Just as a quick last one to end on, I wanted to ask about some of the little Easter eggs, because I'm sure there's tons of them I picked up on. In one of the Hogwarts flashbacks, the name McLagan pops up.
Yes.
You see the Philosopher's Stone in Nicholas Flamel's cupboard.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I wondered as well, that moment where Grindelwald has killed the couple who have the flat in Paris, the boy, their son, their toddler is on the floor, and the framing of that felt very much like the way that you see Harry in the wake of Voldemort's attack. Was that a conscious choice? And what can you tell me about other little kind of notes through that are peppered through the film, alluding back to Harry Potter?
You're also missing a key one.
Oh,
Nagini.
Well, Nagini, of course, obviously by name, and McGonagall, there's plenty. But what can you tell me more about that moment and other bits that people might have missed?
I mean, the killing of the toddler, one couldn't help but reflect and refract on that idea of the boy who lived. So that was visually, it was just an opportunity to sort of echo that in some shape or form. And that was kind of, and that kid, by the way, was amazing.
Mm.
He literally was able to sit there, and we got that in two takes.
Mm-hmm.
I was so impressed by him. There was one scene that we actually
took out. Best actor David worked with on the entire film.
He was.
The only one who most certainly could get two takes and out.
Yeah. Actually, we had a wonderful scene with a baby as well, who was just extraordinary, that we cut out of the movie. It's going to be in the DVD extras.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny had this incredible ability with kids and babies. They would just be so settled in his presence, because he's such a sweet guy.
Mm-hmm.
They would just immediately be hypnotized by him. McGonagall, I thought it was lovely to have back in the stories, and I know some fans have struggled with that. For me, it's an act of generosity and wonder to have such a iconic character back in this world. You know, it's generous, and it's Jo's world. She can kind of do
what
she
wants,
basically.
Also, I really like about that it's just thrown away.
Yeah,
it's not
too.
Like, ooh, this is McGonagall.
Yeah,
you know,
blink and you miss that moment.
As you say, it's sort of something it's like McLagan, you can easily not. It's just about taking it. It's almost like we're in a world where there's magic. You don't, every time you see magic, have to have people go, wow, these are people who are surrounded by it and live with it. So there's an element of taking it for granted. So too, a McGonagall or a McLagan, they're just part of our world.
Mm.
So that was David Yates and David Heyman there talking about Fantastic Beasts and Crimes of Grindelwald. And now it is our turn. And I'm going to say Grindelwald. That's go around the room. Helen, general feelings about this movie and general feelings about where this franchise is going.
Lots of positive bits of the movie. I thought there were lots of beautiful stuff in it, as you would expect of a film made by the people behind this film. And I don't just mean the cast, but just the crews and everything are incredible. They have absolutely the best people on them. So lots of beautiful stuff, lots of gorgeous craftsmanship. I found it a little frustrating because I wanted it to move forward and give me a bit more sense of what the story of these five films is. And I find it quite slow to do that, as I find the last one. I find, you know, there's a lot of people wandering around near the story but not really engaging with the story for large tracts of the film. And I find that perhaps it's realistic, but it's also quite frustrating at times as means of storytelling. So I had some issues. But at the same time, I'm hoping, as I probably said last time, that we've now moved some pieces into place and things are really going to kick off in film number three. So I'm still feeling optimistic about the possibilities here. I think the possibilities are still really exciting.
Let's hope we're not saying this in 2 years' time with Fantastic Beasts 3. Film four, guys, is where it really comes together.
Film five, that's going to be awesome. You know, I want more in the meantime.
You need a satisfaction of now.
Yes, as well as then.
Yeah, delayed gratification ain't good in cinematic terms. Ben?
Yeah, I'm kind of similar to Helen on this. I think I probably preferred the first film. I really like the first Fantastic Beasts. I thought this one is really dark. There's some really dark stuff in this. And I think that one of the things that David Yates, as our director, he does some of the dark stuff really well, I think, especially those latter Potter books. He had some of the really kind of murky, scary, and very sort of grown-up scenes to do in those films. And I think he does that side of the Wizarding World really well. I also really like the fact that it makes just big, bold moves that I think I'm going to be a little bit in limbo about exactly how I feel about them until we see how they play out in the next film, because there are a couple of character decisions here in the very final act of the film that are kind of pretty big gut punches, and I think it remains to be seen whether J.K. Rowling can really stick the landing in where she clearly sees these characters ending up. And at the moment, we're in that middle ground of the shock of what's just happened and waiting to see then how it falls further into place and how these characters are going to kind of face off against each other over the next three films.
Iman?
I'm a lot more negative on this film than Helen or Ben, unfortunately. I mean, the first Fantastic Beasts I thought was so-so, but there were more things I found to like about that movie than in this movie. And just on a plot level and just a scene-to-scene level, I've tweeted after the movie, there are about four or five instances where I was wondering, how did we get here again? when it comes... I was really paying attention, but the editing is really bad. It feels like there's massive chunks of the movie missing. And also it feels like it's one big tease. The end to the revelation, which I'm sure we're going to get to, for me, it's hard to... there's no way that piece of information has not been revealed at any point in the rest of the saga. And it didn't land for me for that reason. But there are things I did like about it. I think Jude Law is definitely a bright spot. Like Helen alluded to, the costume design, the creature design is really, really great. But yeah, on the whole, I did not like this film.
Oh, damn me with faint praise there. I see what you mean. I do feel there's a much longer, perhaps more satisfying version of this movie out there. Mm-hmm. I get the feeling there's a lot of cutscenes. People, as you say, do seem to show up in locations, and we seem to have just, and obviously we, you know, we're not going to watch people get the tube in every single film, but there does seem to be an awful lot cut out. For example, towards the end, you know, suddenly Credence is there. He's at the graveyard. He's just there. And it seems to be almost mid-conversation. And I feel there's a bit of that conversation. And perhaps I'm just being an idiot here, but the scene where Jacob wakes up Nicholas Flamel's...
in the safe house.
The Bordry safe house type thing. That just happens. And it feels to me that if there's so much that's been made of the safe house and how important it is, that there'd be a bit sequence
more
about a bit being revealed and whatnot. But, you know, hey, maybe I'm completely wrong.
I do think there are various kind of slightly disjointed moments in there. And I think the first time watching the film, I've seen it twice now. I think the first time it reminded me a little bit of The Last Jedi, in a sense of the film or J.K. knows where the characters are going, but you as the viewer don't. You're kind of experiencing the shape of the film as it happens rather than the film telling you where it's going to go. And I think on second viewing, bits of it smoothed out a little bit more because you see, you go into it knowing what the characters' journeys are going to be, where they started and where they're going to end up and how their paths are going to cross. But I think in the moment, in that first viewing, when you don't know that, when you don't know quite where it's heading, it does feel a little bit wishy-washy, and then you get those instances of thinking, where am I again, but and who's...
There are also some, I think, real storytelling problems here, in the sense that, you know, for example, you have the dark circus, the Circus Arcanus. There is definitely an implication. In fact, there's a text that the owner is a bad guy who mistreats his creatures. So you would expect Newt to kind of confront him, to have some kind of role in coming up against this person, at the very least to tut at him. I mean, there should be something, and yet
to not look him in the eye and to tell him off.
But by the time Newt shows up, the circus is gone. It's a bizarre decision. And equally, if you're stalling us on the sort of confrontation between Dumbledore and Grindelwald, fine, I get it. You're building up to this epic duel that ends an era in the wizarding world, ends a wizarding war maybe, but then maybe you need to have their sort of proxies, Credence and Newt, have some sort of relationship, because again, if Newt's whole thing is Fantastic Beasts, the protection thereof, then he needs to have some kind of actual chemistry, scene, relationship with Credence, and we didn't get that in the last film.
Yeah,
and we should have got it here.
Yeah, I agree with that. Actually, I think there's. Listen, I went at this movie with ultra low expectations after having heard everyone, and even Ben, who's a massive Potter fan, and he came out with the slightly his face had gone white and his hair had gone white, which is really strange. And I went at ultra low expectations. I saw it last night, and I quite enjoyed it at certain points, but I still have a lot of problems with the look and the feel of these movies, and as they get increasingly darker, I think we're beginning to lose sight of what this franchise started as, which was a fun little tale about a boy wizard, and it had lightness and a darkness as well, obviously, but you have two babies killed in this one. Not just one, but two babies, which is,
It's a little... much.
Yeah,
and I mean, there are those light touches still. I mean, the
it made me laugh a few times. Yeah,
the Chinese dragon-y cat thing.
Oh, the Zowu.
Mm. Yes, yeah. with the bells on the stake. Absolutely adorable. Yeah. Gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had a little bit of a problem with the Selkie, only in the sense that it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous creature design. Sorry, the Kelpie, not the Selkie.
Kelpie.
The Kelpie, gorgeous creature design, great concept, love it.
Where is it going story-wise?
But it's Chekhov's Kelpie. We never see it again. You don't introduce it in Act 1.
Film 5 is going to blow your mind. JK's playing the long game here.
I mean, you got to fire the Kelpie by Act 3. Do you know what I mean? So,
and also that new sort of housekeeper that Newt has, who clearly has a hots for him, and that made me laugh.
Yeah.
Bunty.
Take off your shirt, Bunty. Yes, yeah. Bunty was the name of a girl's comic book. I knew it was something like that. Yeah, take off your shirt, Eddie Redmayne, is something no one has shouted at us on the screen.
Oh, I'm
guessing. I bet a lot of Potterheads will have been.
You think?
Yeah.
You think? Go on, take off your shirt.
Awkward, nerdy Hufflepuffs. Like, what? There is a big portion of the internet that is their type.
Oh, yeah.
It's their go-to.
If he had taken off his shirt and he was mega ripped like Chidi on The Good Place, I would have been so furious.
One of those people who are just kind of scrawny, but you're like, holy shit, you would like really kick the crap out of me.
I've just counted them. He's got 10 abs, guys. This really isn't good. My wife was counting them as well. It was so strange. I'm sure she was taking a picture. It was so bizarre that she was doing that.
You're so obsessed with people being shirtless. Men, specifically.
Am I?
Yeah.
You found my blog. Oh my God.
Shirtlesshufflepuffs.com.
That's 100% an existing blog, I bet.
It probably is.
Oh, I've just
I'm searching for that immediately after this.
Just made another match in Grindr. Anyway, back to the Credence thing.
Yeah.
Which I was talking about 10 minutes ago. I agree with that, because I don't think there's enough... There are too many characters in this movie, which is weird coming from somebody who loves Avengers Infinity War, but that movie, I think, is a masterclass in how to deal with multiple characters. This one, less so.
Yeah.
It loses the thread of so many characters for so long And the movie's emotional climax hinges upon Credence and us being in some way emotionally invested in him. And as good as Ezra Miller is in this movie, he is given less to do this time around than he was last time around. And I didn't feel his pain necessarily, yeah. And I didn't connect with it on that level. And I feel we need to spend a lot more time, and you're absolutely right, he and Newt, if Newt is going to be our hero throughout these five movies, as it seems like
something
he
that
is.
I think he has to justify, because I don't think he's done so yet.
He has become active at some point rather than passive.
And in fairness, that's obviously what the end of the movie is saying, but like, that's two movies in, he's saying, right, I'm going to take a stand. It's like, really? After two movies?
I quite like that, though, because I think the first one really introduces you to him as the adventurer, as the magizoologist. He kind of stumbles into the plot. He is kind of incidental to the plot, whether you like that or not. And I think in this
Except is he? Because it's made clear that Dumbledore sends him to New York in the first place.
Yeah, so I think he is still incidental because Dumbledore sent him to get the bird, the Thunderbird.
Uh-huh.
And it's the coincidence of his case breaking open and the attacks in New York that are conflated, that they think it's his beasts that are causing the destruction in New York, whereas actually it's Credence, and those two kind of plot threads converge.
But even then, do you know what I mean? Like, in the first movie, he should have then been obsessed with finding this Obscurial, and he got distracted by other things throughout.
And they do have a bit of a connection at the end of that first film, where he's the person who was trying to calm him down, saying...
Exactly.
Kind of, because he sees what Credence could become in a bad way, but also that he could still be okay.
Yeah.
And I agree, I did want more of their connection because he is somebody who would be very sympathetic to Credence.
Exactly. And because at the end of this film, you have the whole thing with Credence clearly being conflicted about the choice he has just made, but we have no reason to see why he would be conflicted, because there's no real competing claim on his affections. Our only reason to kind of empathize with that conflictedness is a general, hey, we know Grindelwald's a bad guy, so you should probably be conflicted right now. Oh, you are? Okay, great. I mean, but it's not, there's nothing in the text really that would kind of explain that, I don't think.
Agreed. Should we take some questions?
Yes, please.
Okay, so this question, the first question comes, and this is in completely random order, comes from at 90 Min Film Fest. Now, if you don't know what that is our old chum, Sam Clemens of the Picture House podcast, has launched his own podcast dedicated to films that run for less than 90 minutes.
Cool.
These no Potter movies in there.
It's a good podcast, check it out. Anyway, 90 Min Film Fest asks, so... was Ezra Miller actually the baby on the boat who was swapped by Leeta? Or was that someone else? If so, who was the mother/woman he was with? And then gets a second question in, which is cheeky. Who was the woman Flamel spoke to in his magic book? Now, does anyone feel qualified enough to answer these questions?
Ben Travis.
Okay, so the person in Nicholas Flamel's book is someone called Eulalie Hicks. I wrote down the name when it was in the cinema. We haven't seen her. This is a little bit like when we saw Leeta Lestrange in the first film in picture form, and then we're seeing her in this film. Eulalie is an American witch from Ilvermorny, the sort of American wizarding school, and she's going to appear in the third film, I believe. Jessica Williams is the actress playing her. And yeah, it's already reported that she's going to have some kind of role to play in Fantastic Beasts 3. So I do wonder whether we might actually go to Ilvermorny in the next film. We've heard about it. Obviously, that's where Tina and Queenie went to school. And there's a deleted scene, actually, from the first Fantastic Beasts where they sing the Ilvermorny school song.
Cool.
So... obviously, J.K. is kind of building a bit of a mythology about the school across the pond. But yeah, that is who Nicholas Flamel was speaking to.
As for the bit about the babies, surely we can't have a third random baby on the boat. Like, that would just be too much, wouldn't it? So let's just assume that he's the baby.
And that would mean that theoretically, whoever had that baby is a Dumbledore of some kind, although the whole thing about the Dumbledore reveal that is part of the reason I feel kind of that I need to wait and see what happens in the next film is that news about Aurelius Dumbledore kind of conflicts directly with what we know or what we think we know already about Dumbledore, which is that Dumbledore's mum died when he was like a teenager, you've got Aberforth Dumbledore, who's his brother, who's in the Deathly Hallows. And then you've got Ariana Dumbledore, who was bullied as a kid by some muggle children who saw her using magic. She kind of then started freaking out and having these sort of explosive magical bursts, which it's now since been theorized that she could also be an Obscurial.
Sounds fairly plausible.
But those are the only kind of children that we know that the Dumbledores had, and Albus's dad, I can't remember why, he ended up in prison, and he died in prison, and his mum died before Ariana died. So we don't really know how Aurelius fits into that family tree, if there's going to be some kind of revision of what we know.
If that's even his name.
If that is even his name, although I do think the nod there, that you see the Phoenix, I think it feels like a bit of extra weight to what Grindelwald is telling him, that he is a Dumbledore.
Well, this brings us on to our very next question, which is from Asfar Shah, at Syed Asfar Shah on Twitter. He asks, where does the pod land on the Dumbledore brother reveal? Do they think it's real? Or is it another Trumpian Grindelwald lie? This was a point of some debate in my family. And for the next 5 minutes or so, it'll be a point of some debate in this pod booth. Come on.
I think it's real. I'll be very disappointed if it turns out not to be. The whole film is building up to that moment. So if we then find out in the future film that that was just a fake count, there will be blood.
I don't know. I think every film should end with Credence being told he's someone else.
He's going to be Newt's brother next.
I kind of thought that's where they were going in a right. weird way initially, and the Dumbledore thing did take me by surprise. But why should we believe anything Grindelwald says? Including the pronunciation of his own name.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I just hate it, so I'm inclined to think it's not real. Like, it really annoys me. I don't have a reason, really, for that. But I mean, so the idea of Grindelwald, as he's been explained to us, is that he is the sort of the seducer, in the sense that he will get you to believe things, to act against maybe your best interests or certainly your moral compass, that he can talk anybody around given time. That's why they take his tongue when he's in prison, slightly too late, apparently. But at the same time, many people who act that way do so with around a kernel of truth. So it is entirely possible that he is using one here, and it's just the worst twist in history. I don't know. But yeah, the interesting thing about what he says about what's coming, isn't it, is the vision of World War II, I thought. That was... Mm-hmm. Wait, so his vision is he wants to stop
the Holocaust
yeah. and we're fighting against him? This is...
I don't think that's the case. I think that's part of his kind of rhetoric of saying to other wizards, you need to be on my side because, look, I think
look
we can all coexist, but we should be above them. And look what they're going to do in the future. If we don't take control and do something, this is what the Muggle world is heading to. And
yes.
one of the ways that we can get past that is for you to follow me, because I think... Yes. The wizards.
But that's what I'm saying.
But
that's obnoxious. Because then our bad guy is promising to stop it, and our good guys
I don't think he is.
Not.
I think he's threatening to do something much worse, mm-hmm. but he's seducing them by going, look at this, this is something we can easily prevent. But once he gets them on board, what he has planned for Muggles is a lot worse than
sure,
World War II.
Sure, but we don't know that. We're not told that.
We don't know, but you know, I'm inferring it.
Yeah, but that's the point. We have to infer it. I don't think we should. And I'm not saying because I think people are stupid. I'm just saying you should be clear about why your villain is a bad guy. And I'm not sure that scene for me is really messy.
I've seen some people criticize that. That's for sure. Yeah. I don't read into that what you and others are reading into that, but I can see how you would.
I wanted to rewind for a sec because you said they took Grindelwald's tongue in prison. They undo a lot of things from the first movie, like the first 50 minutes. Like,
yeah.
Credence is alive, and Grindelwald is not in prison.
Mm. And that was... Jacob's memories just magically come back, yeah, which is fine, you know, it's all good.
I had a problem with that. And the opening to the chase sequence, escape sequence, is a little bit confusing.
Mm. Well, and Jacob's memory came back at the end of the first film.
There was a hint.
Yeah, there was a hint.
But I think Amon's right. The first 15 minutes of this basically goes, hey, Credence is dead. No, he's not. He's alive. Hey, Jacob's lost his memories. No, he hasn't. He's got them back again. Grindelwald,
but he's under a different enchantment.
He's under a different enchantment. Grindelwald's in prison now for 3 minutes. And it just feels like, what was the point of the last film?
Yeah.
Why not just start here?
Yeah.
Ben, Henley, can't help this, but I still don't know why Dumbledore places so much faith in Newt to hunt down Grindelwald. It's not clear.
Well, I think it's several things. First of all, I think he can be fairly certain that Newt isn't going to be talked around by Grindelwald, because he doesn't get talked around by really anybody, even when it might be in his best interest to be talked around. So I think that's possibly the major thing. Mm-hmm. Jude Law talked about this in an interview I was in, and he was saying that everybody has that really good friend, the guy who's just a really good person who you kind of go to when you want to know what the right thing to do is, and you avoid when you know what the right thing to do is, but you don't want to do it. Chris is gesturing at himself right now, just so you know. And Jude Law's take was that's Newt for...
Yeah, I think he needs somebody, rather than somebody powerful, he needs somebody incorruptible. I really like that scene between Jude Law's Dumbledore and Newt, where he says, where they're sitting on the bus, and he basically says to him, like, you're a person who I trust. When the time comes, you will do the right thing. Mm-hmm. As passive as you are at the moment, and his brother has already told him, look, you're going to have to pick a side at some point. Mm-hmm. I think Dumbledore trusts in his empathetic nature as somebody who cares. It seems like no one else in the wizarding world really has any sort of care for magical creatures and magical beasts, and that empathy that he has, I think, is the thing that makes him stand out to Dumbledore.
The portrayal of the wizarding world is interesting here generally, isn't it? So there's a very good piece on, I think, the Daily Dot by Gavia Baker-Whitelaw talking about the costumes, because, and she's right. Now, while I adore the costumes, I absolutely want them all in my wardrobe, especially all the coats. She points out fairly that they make absolutely no sense in universe. That as we join the Harry Potter universe, pure blood wizards are quite, and this is following a whole other conflict with Voldemort, pure blood wizards are quite proud of their separateness from muggles. They dress very differently to muggles habitually, day to day, normally. So it makes zero sense that at a time when muggles and wizards were even further apart, that they would dress almost identically to muggles, nomages, non-magique, whatever you want to call them. And actually, there is no good reason in the text that we know of why they would be wearing these gorgeous tailored 20s outfits.
So what you're saying is that Jude Law needs to take his shirt off. Is that what you're saying? That's what I'm hearing.
It's funny that that's what you're hearing.
Hang on. Just got another match in Grindr. I'm not sure if this stuff's saying it, by the way. But it could be fun for us to enjoy in the room. Anyway, but yeah, I get that, but also I don't give a shit because I like those clothes and I want to. And I think Jude Law as Dumbledore is really, really good in this film, and I want more of him next time around. But the problem with that is then that eats into Newt's time.
And all and of these characters. There's so many of these characters to serve.
It does suffer a little bit from that sequel-itis, the problem of the gang's all here, that you liked this person in the first movie, ergo we have to bring them back, and the curse of the sequel, give them a bit more to do. So it's how Shia LaBeouf's parents go from being really a brilliant comic relief in the first Transformers to, oh my god, someone drop a wardrobe on them by the time the third and fourth films roll around.
There's so little character development for so many characters in this movie. Newt's brother, beyond him being an aura and Newt's brother, what do we learn about him? Nothing. Mm. And you can say that about so many characters in this movie. And that's a problem. Mm.
I liked the inclusion of Theseus. I thought he would have more to do, but I liked him as somebody who I genuinely believed in the sort of big brother, little brother relationship there, that his older brother he's a bit more serious, he's a bit more grown up, but he also has a lot of understanding for his brother and why he is the way he is, that when he offers Newt that opportunity at the start to become an aura, to take a stand and to have this pretty badass job, and Newt kind of awkwardly turns it down as you know he's going to do, he's not mad at him about it. He has an understanding with him. Mm. I thought, I do wonder if that's partly where this is heading to, the fact that Newt has decided that actually he does need to take a side in what's coming up, whether one thing we might see over the next few films is him maybe becoming an aura, which I think would be an interesting journey for that character.
Interesting. So who is the, is it Grimson? There's the evil, the clearly evil aura who basically interrupts that meeting with Theseus and the other Aurors and Newt. And Newt clearly has a history with this guy because he leaves the minute he sees him. And then he turns up at Credence's place. He's the one who concocts a spell around himself so that Credence's obscurial powers don't affect him, whereas they've blown everyone else away. And I'm fascinated by that character because he is so obviously evil. Why would the Ministry of Magic send him after Credence?
The Ministry of Magic is notoriously terrible at spotting evil people.
I do think there are slightly too many kind of slightly anonymous kind of old white man characters in this, so you're supposed to kind of know who they are, but they're also not really that distinctive, but they will have on
Film 5's going to blow your socks off, man.
But even the ones who are visually distinct, like is it Rosier Poppy Corby Tush? I only know her name because it's written on IMDb. I don't think she's named in the film.
Yeah, this is
she's
a,
just
yeah.
evil henchwoman. The henchwoman. Yeah. You know, so there's a lot of those kind of characters, and that's fine, to be honest. Like, you don't always need everybody to have a detailed, you know, J.K. Rowling-esque backstory on a screen. I understand that, but at the same time, I don't know, maybe just wouldn't it be more effective if he had a bit more of a sense of the people around him, if he is the great seducer, if he is the great, you know, person who twists people against their instinct.
She's very striking visually, but I see what you mean. There's also that guy, Crawl, who gets consumed by the fire at the end. And again, I just get the feeling there's just more to his story that we haven't seen, and more to that sort of why does the fire consume him? What's it about? Because there's a sense that he's maybe not as committed to Grindelwald / Vault as the others. But we need to see that, I think, rather than, as Helen pointed out, infer it. I just want to go back to a couple of things. Jude Law as Dumbledore, fantastic in this movie. That scene on the bus, was I the only person detecting a slight hint of an Irish accent at times? I thought maybe that was a nod to Michael Gambon. And then the rest of the movie, it's not there.
Yeah, I think he's going for a hint, and sometimes it's not detectable. Maybe.
All right, okay, good. And then at the end of the movie, I told you this is a spoiler special, guys, Lita, when she turns and says, I love you, she's saying it to Newt, right? You know, she doesn't give a shit about Theseus, right?
I think that's what we're meant to think that Newt thinks, at the very least.
Okay, but are we meant to think that Theseus thinks he's saying that she's saying it to him, but in reality, there's a reason why it's a two-shot.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think you might get a moment later on where Theseus thinks she was saying it to Newt, but in the moment, he certainly seemed like he thought it was for him.
I think they both think it's for themselves,
and
they read it in that different way, because I do genuinely, the impression that you get from this is that even though there is still a bit of awkwardness between Newt and Lita, that their love for each other is more kind of friendship love, whereas I think she has a real genuine kind of romantic love with Theseus, and I really like that moment where she turns and says, I love you, and even the way that she delivers that line, you can feel the sort of the part of it that
she should be more specific. She's
huge. Pointing as well.
Theseus, my darling fiance, I love you.
Just for clarification purposes, is anyone taking minutes here? I am looking at Theseus when I say this.
Speaking of love, though, I did think the salamander eyes thing was adorable.
Yeah, that was.
I love that really scene. Nicely played by both.
Yeah. It was very, very.
I think that's one of the best scenes in the film, actually, I think, because I really like the relationship, the kind of slowly the relationship between Newt and Tina that is gradually becoming less awkward. And having revisited the first film after having seen Crimes of Grindelwald, I think it threw into sharp relief a little bit more that when they first meet, they don't get along and they're working kind of against each other. And the fact that then they're like, oh, actually, I kind of like you, and then by this point, they're kind of getting a bit better at showing that to each other. I really like that scene.
Do you think we've seen the last of Lita? Now she's a lot lighter?
Yeah, I mean, so I asked the Davids about this, and one of the things that they kind of said was the death in Harry Potter is final. There's never been an instance other than visions or paintings.
Priori incantatem, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
No character has ever fully come back. And I think that is quite...
Harry's
the only one. There we go. And Voldemort. Apart from the most important characters in the entire Harry Potter saga, but any of the incidental characters, that's a sort of line that they tend not to cross. And I think, I mean, it's pretty fridgy, which is a shame, but I think that part of Lita's death is having to show Newt that actually there are going to be casualties in this situation. You can't sit on the sidelines.
She was in danger of giving the Strange family a good name, so yeah. I guess she had to go. Any other revelations in that last confrontation that surprised you? It's clearly going for Empire Strikes Back vibe, where the bad guys essentially win, the good guys lose. But did you buy the Queenie revelation?
Let's talk about Queenie. Yeah, okay. I was about to say. Yeah, I can see that they did put the effort into building that one up. They did have those moments. They did have her feeling despairing, alone, abandoned. I'm not sure that, like, a day not being able to find your sister in Paris is necessarily enough, but okay, it's on a, you know, accelerated time frame and she is a sensitive person. It still felt quite left field. And I think if you are rooting for the love story between Queenie and Jacob, then it's a real kick in the teeth, which could give it, you know, some really effective drama, I guess, in the next couple of films. So I don't know. Is she not wary when they give her better lipstick? Is that not a sign that she's maybe on the wrong side? Because it's kind of the female equivalent of wearing a skull on your cap, you know? Mm-hmm. The darker lipstick. I just feel like she should know that she's now the baddies.
She gets to Nurmagomed and they go, here's your baddie wardrobe. You're going to wear some slightly more imposing clothes. And...
Exactly.
Did you buy
them off? She does not come off well. With that decision. And isn't she a gentleman's? Like, she reads minds, so, yeah. You know.
I presume she can't read Grindelwald's mind.
Yeah, I assume he can shield against that.
Yeah. Okay. But she still does not come from. And yes, they did try and do some things, but it was far too slight for that moment to land the way it needed to land.
I think it's an interesting idea, and obviously you can look at Grindelwald as analogous to, who's the president of the United States of America at the moment? In terms of the most recent election and even the midterms and the conversations, I think, that have split people down the middle, have actually split families down the middle in the States, where people cannot believe that you would vote for Trump or you would not vote for Trump. Yeah. And I think that, for me, that is an attempt to go in that direction, that you can't believe that Grindelwald has somehow, managed to worm his way into Queenie's affections.
I think one of the slight failings of this film and the last film in the world building, generally the world building is really good, but one thing I think it doesn't get across strongly enough is the idea that normal wizarding society at this point, especially in America, is very strict. That there is no kind of crossing those boundaries that muggles and wizards don't associate. That it's not just that they're kind of separate, that there is a real line there that shouldn't be crossed. And they talk about it a bit, but it's not really come across in a story sense yet. And I think you needed that to come across a bit more strongly to understand why Queenie would make such a big decision when she's kind of, thinking about her relationship with Jacob and making that choice to go with Grindelwald. Because I think one of the things that sticks a bit with that choice is that, yes, the version of his idea that he tells her is that she would be able to get married to a muggle if she wanted to, but also his ideal is that the person that she would get married to he sees as a sort of lesser human being. So I think there is a kind of, it doesn't quite work in that sense. And I think it needed a little bit more behind her choice rather than just, well, I like this bloke, so I'm going to go with the evil guy who says that I can be with the nice man. And I feel like in the first film, her character just has changed a lot between films. And in the first film, she uses the way that people see her, the kind of very blonde, that sense of what she looks like, she uses that against people and their perceptions of her. There's a scene in the first one where she's kind of leaving the ministry with Newt's case and...
Yeah, claims it's ladies' things. So
yes,
he won't
exactly.
Look in it, that kind of thing. Yeah,
and she comes across as very kind of actually like well together, and she kind of uses society's view of who she is against them to get away with things. And I think with this one, it pursues her in a much more troubling light, where she is kind of a bit. She's just kind of a bit crazy and ditzy, and mm-hmm, she's. Mm-hmm. It's really horrible what she does to Jacob. He's really right to kind of be pissed off.
From the off, where she's enchanted him, yeah.
Yeah, and I think as well, the fact that he says to her, look, in the UK, we can get married. It's less strict over here, we can get married. I think that still sticks to the point where you go, so why would she make that huge choice to go with Grindelwald? That even he's not following you across there.
I do wonder what we're missing between films. I thought Alison Siddall was great in the first movie. I'm not a huge fan of the first movie, but for me, she was probably the best thing in it. I do wonder, because at the end of the last movie, she walks back into Jacob's life and there's a hint that he's beginning to remember and everything's hunky-dory and that's a happy ending. Next thing you know, she's enchanted him and is dragging him along to London. What's going on there? We're missing something there. So, you know, it may be filled in.
In discussing this movie with other people, I've said that it plays like a book because all these details that we want to know. In the book, you can see J.K. Rowling filling in all of them, all those details, but obviously you can't do that with a film. It has to sort of, there's a certain flow that the film needs to have, and
it's a different job of structuring, actually.
Exactly, and it feels like either nobody or sort of basically people rarely checked the screenwriter because the screenwriter was J.K. Rowling, and you know, J.K. Rowling knows that.
I've got some notes, Joe. No, you don't.
Yes, you're right. I don't.
I can see it play. I can see it being some sort of version of that because the screenwriting in this is, I mean, either that or there's going to the deleted scenes is going to be a whole bunch.
There were almost never any deleted scenes with the Harry Potter movies. Almost never, because they just had such a huge job to do in so little time. But I wonder if that's going to remain the case in these.
So at Jamie Bolton 1992 asks, is Rowling beginning to meddle too much? What with the big reveal at the end and throwing in fan service like McGonagall, even though she shouldn't have even been born. Is that correct, Ben Travis, the Keeper of the Flame? Why is it correct? Is there canonical?
She shouldn't even have been born.
I'm not sure if she shouldn't
no,
have been.
No, she shouldn't have been born.
But she definitely wasn't supposed to be teaching at Hogwarts by that point.
I'm furious.
I believe she was born in the 30s, canonically.
What?
Retcons,
I'm
going to
tip my chair over now. I'm so infuriated. Does this threaten the integrity of her original stories? See, for me, I didn't know that about McGonagall, and I just thought, oh, that's cute. It's McGonagall. And I like saying McGonagall, so
yeah,
I was quite happy.
It's a fun word. I mean, look, yeah, there are always changes to canon. I mean, we've talked sometimes about the Marvel timeline. I'm not sure if anyone's ever noticed. To be honest, I think you have to hand wave at a certain point to keep your sanity. So I'm going to hand wave that one because it is quite fun, because more McGonagall is always a good thing. But yeah, it is completely wrong and it shouldn't be there, for sure. The problem is, of course, that no other teacher that we know at Hogwarts should have been there at that time. So,
including Dumbledore, or
no, Dumbledore's fine. He's okay. Like 150. He's all right. But like, there's actually very few characters in the Harry Potter era who are even mentioned who would have been alive in the 1920s.
A few people have sent in a question saying, are we annoyed slightly by the sort of contraction of the universe? That again, it's becoming a little bit like Star Wars, and that everyone knows each other or is related to someone who knows each other.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that the only two people of colour who are sort of, you know, featured in any way in this movie happen to be related is a problem. And, you know, it's been heavily documented, but the Harry Potter universe has a problem when it comes to people of colour anyway. And so for that to be revealed in the movie was not, yeah, I didn't like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does make the universe feel quite small in a way, but I think to an extent the Potter universe kind of always has, in that you always got the sense that the wizarding community, in terms of like the old families and things, it was always a relatively small
bunch. We're going to two new countries, so we should be widening that out. And, you know, fair enough, we haven't been to Ilvermorny yet. That's okay. I do think we're going to get there. I think that's coming by the sounds of it in the next film. But, you know, we don't really meet much in the way of French wizards here. We don't get any real sense. I mean, we go around the ministry, but we don't get any real sense of how it operates, what the wizarding laws are in France, how things are.
It's interesting we didn't go to Beauxbatons, because it was already established in the Potter universe that, what the French.
I was thinking exactly the same thing. I wrote that down in, feverish serial killer scroll.
Green ink as well.
Yeah. Why whenever Queenie goes to the French, the Magique de Ministry, which I believe is what they say in France.
Ministre de Magique. Voilà.
Whatever, Helen. Why do they say that they don't know Tina? Is that them weird?
That was a little confusing to me. I think that means that she's there sort of undercover. Like she's not on an official mission to France. But again, that's not something that's actually addressed. And she gives the impression to everyone else that she is. And it's weird as well, because in this film, she's very much kind of got her groove back. She is officially an Auror again. She's officially back in her comfort zone of being an Auror. So why would she then immediately risk that by chasing off to France in pursuit of an Obscurial? It is bizarre. And again, I think if they had done a better job in the first film of building up some kind of relationship between Newt and Credence, she could have actually, even if she did so in a grumpy manner that suggested that she was cross with him, sent Newt, and I think that would have been more efficient. It does feel weird for us to be criticising J.K. Rowling's storytelling, because like, she has like a billion reasons why she's better than any of us. But even so, like, I do think that there are some weird choices here.
I do wonder if the story is more fleshed out in her head than what we see on the screen, and actually agreeing with what you guys have said, that somebody like Steve Clovis, who did a really good job, actually, I think, generally in finding through lines through the Harry Potter books, especially the later ones, finding what that central thread is and then wrapping some of the other stuff around where possible, that having somebody like that to just help guide, okay, this is what the story is, but this is what you need to show and this is what you need to tell and this is when things need to happen. That is something I would hope to see going forward, but I think it will be her authorship all the way, I think.
It is fascinating because obviously with the books, we knew from a very early stage it was going to be 7 books and she knew she had pretty much the entire story in her head. I don't think too much came to her at the 11th hour. And you have to imagine this is the same thing as well, but this is a different... A different medium, different art form, and it's going to be interesting to see if our patience is rewarded. A fifth film, it's going to knock your socks off.
I am looking forward to Dumbledore versus Grindelwald. I would say that. Looking forward to seeing that on screen. But if you ask this list anything else, I'm really looking forward to it. At this point, I would struggle.
What do we think of the reference? Do we think it was a somewhat coy reference to Dumbledore and Grindelwald? Again, and their romantic relationship again, in the past.
You know, there was a really good article about sort of how films should, when they're talking about sort of gay characters, actually sort of go full hog. And I think it was written by Amy West in the previous issue of Empire Magazine. This is another one to add to that list. If you're going to do that, actually go for it and do it and make an impact for that minority.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we can't keep having this sort of these mentions off screen. Oh, Lando is pansexual, or you know, Dumbledore is gay. It's like, okay, but like, I mean, it doesn't. They don't have to be R-rated sex scenes. Just, but you know, in the same way that you would show a heterosexual couple being a heterosexual couple, you should do the same with a gay couple or a lesbian couple or a pansexual droid man couple in the Millennium Falcon. I don't know.
This is a weirdly chaste world, although I noticed there were quite some, probably the first time in the Potterverse, there were costumes that were on the risque side, but it's quite a chaste world. I mean, obviously, Newt and Tina have that endless Richard Curtisian flirtation that may never be consummated until, I tell you what, guys, I'm sorry, it's going to knock your socks off, but... You know, and Jacob and Queenie have their own thing going on.
Sorry,
but
not so much not knock your socks off as knock boots.
Knock boots. Hey. Helen, there's going to be so much shirtlessness in film 5.
You're obsessed with
my blog. I will be updating it for days. Oh, I just got another hit in Grindr. No. Oh, dear. Do you like attractive single wizards in your area? Anyway.
Sure.
Should we talk very, very quickly? We probably should have a little bit more time to talk about this guy, but nevertheless, he's the title character. The Crimes of... Grindelwald. Grindelwald, played by Johnny Depp. We've talked at length on the Empire podcast about how replacing Colin Farrell with Johnny Depp was a bit boneheaded, but you also have to take the performance itself and the character itself and set everything else aside, as hard as that may be. What do we think of Depp? What do we think of Grindelwald? Do we think that we can replace him with Colin Farrell again in the next movie?
Oh no, he's had a tragic overdose of polyjuice potion. Oh no, he's stuck looking this way now forever.
Oh my God, that's dreadful, dreadful. Do we think that, you know, to horribly paraphrase Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, you do eventually plan to have some Crimes of Grindelwald in your Crimes of Grindelwald movie?
He does kill 2 people and a baby.
He has other people do it for him.
That's, you know, it was his crime.
Well, you're a barrister. I'm not going to argue.
I didn't think he was bad, but he wasn't great either. Colin Farrell was, for me, the best thing about Fantastic Beasts, the first film. So definitely underwhelming. It's done now. I don't think they should have kept him, but it is what it is. He was fine. There were certain scenes where he was compelling to watch, I think. When he's giving this big speech in the final act of the film, I thought that was pretty good. But yeah, I can see Colin Farrell doing a much better job.
I think he's good in the time that he has in the film, which isn't a huge amount actually, considering he's the title character. But the scenes that he gets are relatively meaty, and I think he does, purely performance-wise, a good job, but I don't think he's so good that he's irreplaceable.
Okay, so refresh my memory here for the last few Potter films, because as far as I can remember, the Potter films take place almost exclusively from Harry's POV. He's in almost every single scene, right? So we don't see that many scenes where it's just Voldemort plotting with his goons, right? So the change for this movie, where we do spend quite a bit of time with Grindelwald and his goons, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that, but it is true. I think we're supposed to get more of an insight into his head, I suppose, and where he's coming from, which I'm not 100% sure that we really did anyway.
I think you need it for him because of what he does, in that he has his extreme views that he talks about when he's alone with his people, and they have that scene in the French house where he says, "No, we don't say this aloud. This is what we believe, but we don't say this version of it out loud." I think you need that insight into his more interior world, so that then you can see the difference when he's in front of the public, the version that he says in front of other people.
Yeah,
I think there's a really interesting, I don't think it was a misstep necessarily in how the character is designed, but he looks so weird and off-putting that I'm not sure that you entirely buy that he is as charming or as seductive as we are meant to believe, that he has rallied all these people around. Then again, what do I know? The America is governed by a man who's wearing some sort of weird ferret on his head. So,
I actually agree with that. I think he should probably look better. I mean, just on purely, you know, base level, look how good Jude Law looks in this film, and then look at his ex-boyfriend. Like, come on, you're generally couples look approximately as attractive as each other. You know, you kind of want to have that sort of equivalent. And also just like in terms of dynamics, it gives you a sort of the same dynamic between the two. You want that equivalence, dramatically speaking, to set up this face-off. I'm guessing the idea is that the dark magic that he's used has eroded his look somewhat, given him the weird eye, all that kind of thing. But it is a distraction that I don't think is necessarily effective.
Two really quick points. Grindelwald, all the way through the film, talks about how Credence is going to come to Lem, which is very Emperor Palpatine, not Noel Edmonds, and I'm a celebrity. And in the end, he goes to Credence. He shows up on the roof and goes, "Hey, going to come to the cemetery of big character reveals tonight.
Carlos,
we're having
a big
old party." That's the French translation, the cemetery of big character reveals.
It's really not. It's Father Lachaise.
Father of the big character reveals. That's what that means. So that's a little point that you don't have to respond to that. But
it's a real place, by the way. People can go to the cemetery.
Paris.
It's where Jim Morrison's buried, and Oscar Wilde. But I don't know about the big underground room with the blue fire.
I don't think that's a thing. And the very last question comes from Logan Jane Nicholson. What was everyone's favourite beast?
Zowu. And the Niffler. God, I love that Niffler. And he's got a poorly foot at the end. And he was a good boy who got the blood pact.
He
made the biggest impact in this film, because I think the blood pact thing that it ends on, that is the reason that Dumbledore and Grindelwald can't go against each other, because they made that pact. Now, Dumbledore has it. If he can find a way to break it, then he can move against Grindelwald. And that's all down to that Niffler. He's very good. I like him.
They're good Nifflers, Brant.
Good
14
Nifflers.
Out of 10 for that Niffler.
Hecking good.
Hecking good Niffler. If anyone wants to follow us on our new Twitter account, We Rate Nifflers, then do check us out there. That would be an amazing Twitter account. Anyway, that is it for our Fantastic Beasts and Crimes of Grindelwald spoiler special. It has been an absolute blast. Next spoiler special, there's a lot of them coming over the next few weeks, will be for Creed 2 with the director Stephen Caple Jr. And that's going to be a lot of fun. And then after that, Aquaman. Aquaman with director James Wan. I'm really looking forward to seeing that movie. I probably should leave so I can go and do that. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you in the meantime, of course, to Helen O'Hara.
Thank you.
Ben Travis.
Goodbye.
Amon Worman.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to update my blog on shirtlessness in movies. It's a lifelong task, guys. It's a tough cross to bear. Someone's got to do it. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.
Especially bearing it shirtless.
Oh, got another matching grinder.